Hi, friends. Welcome back to another episode of Peer Connections, the podcast series brought to you by the Global Peer Financing Association, also known as GPFA. These podcasts offer our GPFA members and global beneficial owner friends a forum for information sharing and discussion on topics most important to them. And we hope you, our listeners, appreciate the insights, best practices, and transparency offered from our members and industry friends about securities, finance, or related investment areas. Now let's get into the episode. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Peer Connections. My name is Chris Benish. I'm a senior portfolio manager here at the State of Wisconsin Investment Board. I'm also a board member and the treasurer of the Global Peer Financing Association. GPFA tries to bring educational information and opportunities to our membership and the industry at large. Today, I have joining me Brock Bell from the Virginia Retirement System. Brock, welcome.
Excited to be here. Thanks, Chris.
So Brock, you've been at Virginia for a little more than a year and a half. Tell us a little bit about your role there and where you were prior.
Sure, happy to. I'm the Director of Treasury at VRS. We're the State Pension Fund of Virginia, as you mentioned. We run about $126 billion in total assets across public and private markets. I work within our Portfolio Solutions Group, which is a cross-asset team of investment professionals and portfolio managers. I manage the core treasury functions like liquidity management, cash and collateral optimization, counterparty risk, and financing across all asset classes, and also manage an enhanced cash investment strategy.
Very interesting. And prior to VRS, where were you in the industry?
So started in the securities finance industry right out of college. I graduated from Princeton in 2006. Started my career at Barclays and their sales and trading program, and spent the first 10 years of my career at Barclays, Morgan Stanley, and JP Morgan, all in different types of securities finance trading roles. I built out the treasury and portfolio finance function at Capstone Investment Advisors, the multi-strategy hedge fund, for about 6.5 years, and was also head of treasury at Hidden Road, a multi-asset prime broker, before coming down to VRS about a year and a half ago. VRS decided they wanted to employ leverage, which was a new initiative for the fund, and they brought me in to build out the treasury function.
Great. We're really excited to have you join us today, and certainly your perspective coming from the sell side will be incredibly valuable as we talk through some of these trade ideas. So Brock, why don't you tell us a little bit about your structure at Virginia Retirement System, how VRS employs leverage, and how you're involved in some of these strategies?
Sure. So we run about $126 billion in total assets across public and private markets. On the public side, we have public equities and fixed income. And on the private side, really have three main private asset programs. And that's real assets, which is largely real estate and infrastructure, credit strategies, and private equity. We also have an allocation to what we call diversified strategies. These are meant to diversify the return streams and the risk exposures across market cycles in different investing environments. And there's really two different types of diversified strategies. One we call risk responders. These are generally things that are negatively correlated to the rest of the plan assets. You could think of something like tail risk protection as a good example of this. Basically something that's long volatility. When there's a big shock to the market or a big drawdown, we would expect these to perform well. The other is what we call return enhancers. These are things that aren't negatively correlated to the rest of the plan assets, but are completely uncorrelated to the rest of the plan. And here, you really have traditional hedge fund strategies. So things like relative value, volatility, global macro, and different types of arbitrage strategies. We also have a small allocation to cash and a few other things. I think it's really interesting to talk about our motivations and rationale for using leverage. And it's much different than how most hedge funds and many other levered funds use leverage. And I think it's also different than how a lot of people, even people that have a lot of experience in financial markets, tend to think about it. So when most people think about why you'd use leverage, really what comes to mind most frequently is just enhancing returns. So you think of something like a pretty plain vanilla treasury cash versus futures basis trade. Typically, those have pretty thin spreads. You might be looking at something like a 25 basis point P&L forecast. So if you are looking at that potential trade, you need to lever it 40x just to get a 10% or an attractive annualized return. The VRS, the motivation and the rationale for leverage is quite different. There's really three or four main reasons why we want to deploy leverage. One, to free up capital to invest in private assets and our diversified strategies. Two main reasons for this. One, it diversifies returns and reduces the risk of the overall portfolio. So it's a little counterintuitive, right? By taking leverage, because we're investing in things that are uncorrelated or even negatively correlated to the rest of the plan, we're actually reducing risk of the portfolio. Second is the illiquidity premium. So particularly in private markets, you lock up money over a longer period of time, you expect to get higher returns. The second one is it gives us additional liquidity for retiree disbursements. In the state of Virginia, looking at our actuarial projections, and this goes for most of the country where you have a lot of baby boomers retiring, we're expecting our retirees to go up, and therefore our monthly retiree disbursement estimates are also going up. So this gives us additional liquidity for that. Third, it gives us a dry powder facility. For example, if we see a new investment or a new opportunity, or we want to take advantage of a drawdown period where assets are at attractive prices, we're not in a position where we have to sell one asset to buy something else. We're not a forced seller. We can simply tap into our available funding resources and make those investments. Finally, just as an auxiliary benefit, we do expect it to be a positive carry trade. So in most years, we expect that our investment returns are going to exceed the cost of leverage. And so over time, we expect it'll increase returns.
That's an incredible opportunity set that you guys have developed. I'm curious, as you developed your leverage program, did you enter it knowing you would have those different strategies employed, or has it been an evolution as you've employed leverage?
I would say it's been an evolution. You know, the things that I outlined, that was really the rationale and the strategic plan. And then coming in, the things I've been working on and building really is making sure that we're able to get access to funding through different funding channels, different account structures, and a variety of liquidity providers and counterparties.
That's great. So maybe talk a little bit about how you access some of those liquidity channels.
Yeah, so historically, VRS has a long-standing securities lending program. One way we're able to access liquidity and funding is through a mechanism called cash release. So basically what we're doing is we have the ability to borrow back cash collateral on the back of our public equity and fixed income securities loans. So that's been a core funding source for us, something that we've had in place for a while. We've also onboarded several new ISDA counterparties for index swaps and single security total return swaps. One thing that we're also working on is prime brokerage, something that we expect to launch in the near future.
So, Brock, from the beneficial owner's perspective, how would you think about utilizing the swap capability in regards to how it interacts with your balance sheet or other positions you might have on?
I think there's a few different motivations that you have from a beneficial owner or from a buy side perspective, why you'd be motivated to move a position from cash to swap or vice versa. One of the biggest considerations is obviously going to be a better financing rate. So I think a good example of this, let's say that you have a cash equity long position, either at your PB or custodian, where it's trading special and you're not getting a market rate. In this case, you could sell your physical cash equity, buy it on swap with a swap dealer who's willing to pay you something close to that market spot rate and be able to monetize that value. Another benefit would be reducing margin. So, for example, if you have a cash equity position that sits within a portfolio or within a margin methodology where you're hit with a concentration or diversification add-on, and you can move it to a swap dealer where it has better standalone margin or a natural risk offset with the rest of your swap portfolio, you're basically going to be able to reduce margin on both sides. So capital efficiency, freeing up capital being an important benefit there. Dividend and tax treatment, that's something that depending on your tax jurisdiction, your trading, that could be a consideration as well. Another important one is return metrics. So it's obviously important to be a good partner to your counterparties. You want to make sure that you're ensuring you have a healthy, mutually beneficial mix of business. Dealers are often very transparent with names that are good fits and bad fits. They'll communicate that with you. They'll publish things like Axlis. So being able to improve your return profile as a client, you know, that's something that could have a positive impact across the whole firm. Another big one is customization. One of the benefits of a swap wrapper is that you're able to customize all the different terms of a trade. So I think a couple good use cases for this would be getting a termed financing rate. As we know, the securities lending business, PB, and your agent lending business, and I think especially from a pension fund perspective where we have observable benchmarks, being able to minimize that benchmark basis risk is pretty valuable.
That was a great rundown. Thanks for walking us through that, Brock. I'm curious, given all the different kinds of trading activity that a beneficial owner might contemplate, what advice would you give to a fund or a beneficial owner looking to institute some of this from an infrastructure perspective? What legal agreements or trading capabilities are necessary to make some of this stuff work?
Yeah, really good question. So starting with legal agreements to trade swaps, first thing you need obviously is an ISDA agreement. And there's a few different subsets of agreements within that. So you have your ISDA master agreement, which is your base agreement. And then there's a couple other annexes that support that. You have your CSA, which is your credit support annex. That defines eligible collateral that you can post and receive. Also covers things like minimum transfer amounts and collateral timing. You also have eligible collateral schedule, or an ECS. This is a little more detail in the eligible collateral that's required if you're in scope for UMR. There's also what's called an MCA or a master confirm agreement. This isn't required, but it's definitely helpful. It helps you define standardized terms for your swap trading and avoids having to go through and sign a separate long form confirmation agreement for every single trade. So that definitely helps make things more operationally efficient.
And when I think about these trades, is there any of this that could be facilitated through a traditional securities lending agent?
Typically, the way these trades are done is the swaps are done with an ISDA counterparty. And then for the physical cash equity hedge, those are generally pointed to your PB or custodian. Historically, agent lenders haven't been involved in facilitating this business, but in the last few years and very recently, a couple of the bigger agent lenders have begun building out swaps capabilities. So I think that you're definitely seeing the market evolve from that perspective.
I've heard similar rumblings to that effect. It'll be interesting to see how the market evolves in the near future. Coming back to the beneficial owner's perspective again, what about governance? What controls these sorts of trades? Is there a risk budget involved? What drives the risk appetite on the beneficial owner side?
I think in terms of governance, it's important to get buy-in from senior management. You want to make sure that they understand and value the function, you know, first and foremost. I think other things like proper accounting, proper reporting, you know, those are very important. Just making sure that you can accurately reflect risk in the positions that you have on. In terms of controls and a risk budget, two things are extremely important in managing the process. One is a strong liquidity management process. You need to ensure you have enough capital to meet any initial margin, variation margin, and settlements. Also a strong counterparty risk management process. So remember, with OTC counterparties under an ISDA, you have direct bilateral credit risk. It's important that you have a robust process in place to analyze and monitor counterparties and counterparty risk.
That makes a ton of sense. We've talked a lot about swaps so far, but we all know the universe of derivatives is quite vast. Are there other types of structures, other types of instruments that you have seen used to facilitate trades like this or other types of trades?
Yeah, so there's definitely other types of derivative instruments that can be effective financing tools, especially around portfolio rebalancing. So derivatives aren't just used to finance individual single security positions, but are also good tools to rebalance an entire portfolio. One thing that we utilize are what we call derivative overlays for rebalancing, primarily index swaps and listed futures. These are effective tools that you can use to quickly rebalance exposure into asset class target weights. And there's going to be a couple trade-offs between these instruments. So futures, for example, very high liquidity in terms of both bid offer and market depth. Typically, margin for most listed futures contracts are pretty low, so they're very capital efficient. So futures are going to be a very effective blunt tool to get quick exposure with low capital commitment and low trading costs. And then on the other hand, another good tool are index swaps. And these are things that are very effective if you want to get and if you value and prioritize customization. These are great tools to reduce or completely negate any benchmark basis risk. A drawback of these is typically they're not as liquid as futures. Bid offer is going to be a little bit wider. And typically you have higher margin requirements for index swaps than futures. So I guess the way I'd frame it is if you have more time to act and you're willing to pay a little bit more in terms of transaction costs, in return, they allow you to be a little more surgical, a little more precise.
So Brock, you talked a lot about rebalancing and the use of derivatives in the rebalancing process. I know at SWIB, something we think about is how different asset classes behave differently in synthetics, and some are certainly easier than others to replicate. How do you think about that across different asset classes, be it large cap, small cap, US, EM?
The way I'd frame it is generally the more liquid asset classes are going to be easier. So for example, US large cap equities or US treasuries, they're going to be easier to rebalance than foreign or emerging market, small cap or sovereign debt. You're going to be able to access the market faster, bid offer spreads will be tighter, and you're likely to have less in the way of trading costs and then also complexity. You know, note that for foreign markets, you carry additional types of risk like FX risk, for example, where the US, you don't have that additional complexity.
With these different swap related structures that you've talked about, talk to us a little bit about the prime broker's motivation for these trades.
For the prime broker, it's really about optimizing around the entire alphabet soup of regulatory ratios, and there's a lot of them. And there's really four key ratios that the cash for swap trades really solve for from a PV perspective. First one's going to be balance sheet reduction. These trades can improve supplementary leverage ratio or SLR profile because the bank's able to reduce on balance sheet assets. Another one's going to be improving stable funding under a ratio called net stable funding ratio or NSFR. This is a regulatory ratio that measures the stability of a company's funding and liquidity profile. And dealers can, through these types of trades, they can improve their NSFR by either increasing available stable funding, ASF, or reducing required stable funding, or RSF. And then the third is going to be about liquidity. So improving their liquidity profile under the liquidity coverage ratio, or LCR. This is a ratio that ensures banks basically maintain ample liquidity. Moving positions from cash to swap can improve LCR because it allows the bank to remove physical assets from its balance sheet and simultaneously raise cash. The fourth metric combines a lot of these different elements, but is actually the most impactful. That's called GSIB, or Globally Systemically Important Bank. This is a December 31st snapshot as it stands now. There have been rumors that this could change in the future. This is what's created a lot of year-end balance sheet stress and has driven a lot of the motivations for dealers to optimize their balance sheet, oftentimes through these types of cash versus swap trades.
It's good to understand the motivations there. Brock, it's been really interesting to hear your perspective on these trades. I'll be honest, listening to you talk about some of the things that you're involved with, that VRS is involved with, I hear a lot of echoes of strategies that SWIB has employed over the last several years, ways that we seek to raise leverage, ways that we structure our liquidity, things that we think about when putting our program together. It's been really interesting to hear your perspective as well and get some more insight into how VRS is thinking about these things, how other market participants might think about these strategies, and some best practices, right, around how to risk govern and manage some of the logistics around these sorts of trades. Really appreciate you sharing your perspective today.
Thanks for having me. Enjoyed our conversation and it was a pleasure being here.
Appreciate you being a part of it. I think that wraps it up for today. Brock, thank you for being here. For our listeners out there, please look for the GPFA in the future at various industry events. We've been partnering with a lot of different organizations and events in our industry and try to provide a space for GPFA members to gather at those events. Also, GPFA is always looking for topics that people are interested in hearing about. So please send us your questions, send us your ideas, and we'll look to schedule a future podcast about it. Thanks for listening. Thanks for listening to another episode of Peer Connections by GPFA. We hope you found the information shared in this podcast interesting and beneficial. And as always, please feel free to reach out to GPFA with ideas or interests for future episodes. And if you liked what you heard today, don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Now for the disclaimer. The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the presenters and do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of their respective employer organizations. This material is for your private information and does not constitute legal, tax, or investment advice. There's no representation or warranty as to the current accuracy of nor liability for decisions based on this information.